Okay, thank you everyone for coming. You know, clearly there's a lot of wisdom and experience in this room in terms of serving and being involved in a number of boards. So, you know, feel free throughout to ask any questions. I know you will, or make any comments as I run through. But I thought this handout would just sort of provide a framework about what to think about in terms of questions board members should be asking the CEO about the competition. And going to really address four areas today. First, you got to start with the role of the board, because I think just getting that framework is important. Then I'm going to discuss questions to ask the CEO about the competition, some watchouts to avoid, and you probably have a lot more to add in, and then also some ideas that we've seen to better understand the competition. Because, you know, having served on, I don't know how many boards over the years, currently I'm on six, and several private, but we also work with and advise a number of boards and CEOs. So I first want to start with the role of the board, which put down here as strategy, 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 right? And I think it's very important when you look at where and how boards are spending their time, that you want to make sure as a board member you're spending 50% or more of your time on strategy. And if you do analysis, in fact we just went through analysis of extensive one of a board, that's not where they tend to spend their time. Publicly held boards, it's a lot of regulations today and SOX and understanding the risks obviously, but even private boards where a lot of time tends to be spent in the dog and pony shows for the board instead of really, you know, getting everyone in the room to participate and asking their input. And clearly, I mean, this is a primary board objective, is to have strategy, and you also want to have a board of different voices and different perspectives in terms of provide, just like this could be a great board. Any questions on that or comments, or should I keep going? The second thing you want to do is help direct the CEO to the most critical few things to work on and ensure those things relate to the overall long-term strategy. You know, focus on the few. You got to decide what you want to win at. Don't try to be everything to everybody. You're just going to end up losing, and be willing to make trade-offs. And again, what we see in particular with a lot of middle market companies is the CEO in particular tries to do too much and then wonders why they can't get everything done. So really picking the few and going after that. The third point here is really important, about encouraging honesty and objectivity from the management team and the board at all times, and that board members should really feel free to present dissenting voices. And that doesn't mean after the board meeting, that doesn't mean one-on-one, that doesn't mean in the parking lots, I mean that means at the board meeting. And again, depending on the company and the board, some of them encourage that more than others. But we believe that is crucial to having, you know, a well-performing board. Ask the CEO what information the board needs to see on a regular basis and also how it should be presented. It's important to see the board as a resource and present information in a summary format with attachments. So don't just send out hundreds and hundreds of pages, which I'll talk about later too, which some of these boards do. And then the board members get them and they're like, what am I supposed to do with this information? I mean, tell me what is important and present it in a way in which these are the issues or these are things you want to highlight. Ellen, did you want to say something or not? Oh, okay. Any comments or questions so far? This is just sort of setting the framework. Support or change the CEO. If you support the CEO, you know, make sure you give the CEO all the tools needed to succeed, because your role as a board member is to partner with the CEO to make the company successful. If it's not the right CEO, then you either got to bring in someone to coach the CEO to try to help him become the right CEO, or you need to change the CEO. I mean, that's your options, obviously, as a board. And the board really has to be a catalyst for long-term success and willingness to take educated, calculated risk to create long-term value. Because, again, what we see often is the CEO gets involved in a lot of day-to-day decisions and isn't able to necessarily focus on the future and what's going to create the value for the company, for the enterprise, 3 to 5 years from now.
Larry, just a comment.
Sure. Yeah.
But link back to point number one.
Yep. Right?
I see this often in privately held businesses where they tend to be very insular.
Right.
And in fact, a lot of these companies don't have a CEO. They have a COO.
Right.
And they may surround themselves with a board, and it's up. When you say change the CEO, it's called sort of elevate the COO to actually be the CEO.
Right.
So I think that's what you got.
Right. I agree with that. What do other people see or feel? Is this things you're seeing out there?
I'd love to see 50% of the time.
Oh.
Strategy.
Well, we're actually having some of our board now divide the agenda so that start with strategy first. Don't do it last. 50%, you've got your strategic issues for the year. Say there's three of them or four of them. Half your board meeting is on the strategy, and you allocate the time, and then the other half is on all the other things you want to cover. So it encourages you, it gives you that discipline up front. So we're big fans of that. We see it working. It takes a while for it to work, but it can work very effectively.
The interesting thing I found is that you set the strategy, and you do this once every 2 or 3 years. You get the board together, and you go do big strategy session. Right, and I was on one board for 12 years. I think I went through 4 different strategy sessions. You know, each one had a little pivot to it.
Right.
And then you get to the board meeting, and all of a sudden everything that's coming up is off strategy.
Right, right.
It's like, explain to me why we're doing this.
Sure.
I mean, part of the issue of strategy is, what do you say no to?
Right, and that's where we're big fans of picking the few. Part of picking the few isn't just deciding what you're going to focus on as a company, it's deciding what you're not going to focus on.
Exactly.
And you've got to make those decisions.
My experience often,
yes, ma'am,
in working with CEOs and with boards, my experience, unfortunately, has been some adversarial. Does that happen?
Never.
So, which can sometimes impede the encouragement of honesty and objectivity. So, how have other people managed to encourage that honesty and objectivity, given some of the adversarial conversations that take place? I'm just curious.
When you say adversarial, are you talking about division within the board or board versus CEO?
Board, sometimes all the above. Board versus, most often, my experience has been board versus CEO and management team. So the CEO and management team spend inordinate amounts of time trying to put together things that they think the board wants to see versus an actual honest and objective dialogue.
So the question is, do you have the right CEO? And it goes back to Larry's point.
Right, you want a CEO who's going to be, okay. So what we've found works is you got to go slowly and carry a big stick, right? I mean, you got to start off slowly. I mean, the first thing is you want some one-on-one time with the CEO. And if you've decided to embrace the CEO and get behind him, tell him or her, you know, we want to support, we want to help you. We want to help you create value for this company. That's going to benefit you. It's going to benefit the shareholder. You know, everyone is going to benefit. Let us help you do it. But to us, you've got to do it slowly with something. You can't just come in and start and say, if we're challenging you in certain situations, we're challenging you to make the company better. So they can't take it or see it as a personal thing. They have to see it as we're all aiming. We're all aligned. We're all aiming for the same target.
Thank you.
I don't know if that's helpful.
No, it is. Thank you.
The other part of that, Mary, is the board as a group, not necessarily including the CEO, has to be willing to I think, set those type of behavioral standards. But we're not going to allow piling on. We're not going to support one-sided positions or one-sided arguments where somebody can raise an objection, somebody can say something that's not a party line and they're not shunned by the masses. If they're not willing to do that as a group, then you have real problems. You're encouraging the type of monothink that either the CEO or maybe some other, the chairman decides this is what the party line should be and nobody else is willing to digress from that without risk of a severe injury.
My observation is that sometimes companies have a cultural orientation to circle the wagon, mm-hmm. and if the board isn't in tune with that, then there's going to be a level of friction that will always take place, and it'll become very adversarial. So I think if you become a member of the board and get to understand the culture of the company a little bit, you can change it, but that's how some companies operate. Some companies are open, and their teams, especially privately held, they operate that way. Others are, you know, we'll tell you what we're going to tell you, and you're going to get plenty of window dressing, and we're going to meet with you once every 3 years to tell you what we're working on, but then you hear other things. So I think culture has a very big role there.
Yeah. Right.
And,
I agree.
And you've got to keep pushing at it.
Can I push back on what you just said, though? Because, you know, in public companies, you have very clear fiduciary responsibilities. And if you're not poking and prodding and pushing and asking the right questions and, frankly, putting the CEO at times in a discomfort, and, of course, making sure he understands why he's being put in a discomfort, then you don't have a good fiduciary board. Because otherwise, there's not the kind of positive, constructive disagreement or conversation going on at the board level. But I actually wanted to go back to your first question, which was before Mary brought up her topic, which was the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I see is my private companies functioning very differently from my public companies.
Right.
My private companies, it's all about strategy and implementation, and that's 90% of what we do. With the public companies, with all the, again, fiduciary compliance and everything else, what we've been doing more and more as the years have gone on is moving as much of that into committees, having short committees report out at the public, at the boards, so that you can still take 50% of your time on. And we don't even look at it as strategy. It's everything. It's about sales, marketing, strategy tied together, and that's 90% of the board meeting versus having it 90% compliance. But that's the way my board, public boards have dealt with all the compliance issues that are just part of life.
Just one more, and then we'll.
What interests me about these points is the fourth point, which is the information. And I'm curious, what data sets do you see and use to help be strategic as a board member, as well as to help the leadership team be more strategic about their intentions and their direction? So what data sets do you use?
Well, so, and we're going to answer that as we go along, but basically it's very much company and industry specific in terms of what metrics you're going to end up using in terms of the data. But we'll get into that. How about with the competition? So let me just continue along. Embrace mistakes, but learn from them. So, and this probably relates to encouraging honesty, but we think it is great when the CEO gets up there and says that, look, we tried something, we test out, it didn't work, let us tell you why and what we learned from it. So you want to be, I mean, our opinion is you want to encourage that if you're not making mistakes, you're not taking any risks. So now we get into the questions you asked the CEO about the competition. We're making some assumptions here. You've defined your market space. You define what space you want to play in, what you want to win it. You focus on the few, and you focus on the value you're adding and how you're differentiated from the competitors, because everything is done relative. So question number one that we believe to ask the CEO about the competition is, what is your company's value add, and how and why is it different from your competitors? So is what you're doing valued by your customers? Do they even care what you're good at? And if your offering has no value differentiation than your competitors, then it just becomes a price game, which, you know, you don't want to be in the competitive business. You don't want to be in that commodity business. So, but we think that's the question number one you got to ask. What is your value add? And how and why is it different and differentiated from your competitors, whether it's a service or product to the marketplace? Number two is, do you have a SWOT analysis, strength, weaknesses, opportunities, threat, or a product matrix chart comparing your product or service, again, with your competitors in the marketplace? So look at what you're good at, look at what they're good at. You know, do you understand the critical risks involved? you know, do a product matrix, product with product and service offerings, and then do a layering over your competitors. And again, honesty, you know, because, and then we'll talk about it later about somehow with the competitors, a lot of people are like, ah, don't worry about, well, you need to worry about them. Third thing, what does the competition do better than us? Are they testing new products faster to market? Is there customer service? Are there higher margins? And then how do you know this? So we're big fans of asking your customers or your clients, because that's where you start to really see the gaps. Ask them, you know, what are our competitors doing we're not? What is competitor A doing? Are they doing different things than us in the marketplace? Because and not that there's anything wrong with SurveyMonkey, but we think it really should be conducted by a third party who conducts these interviews either by person or by phone. Because, I mean, these ratings that go on out there where you're rating 1 to 10, I mean, the relevant question to ask is if someone rates you a 7, you got to say, well, what would make them a 10, right? Because that's the answer you want. And then you start to hear, well, wait, this is the issue, or so-and-so, or their competitor, like, that's what you want to know. Now, some people say, I don't rate anybody a 10, it's 9. What would make them a 9? So that's really the meat of the conversation. And that's what we want to understand. So you're basically able to do a matrix out there, understanding this is how we're positioning ourselves, and these are how our key competitors are, depending on what market you're playing in, and depending on how you've defined your marketplace. Who are the market leaders? Who are the up-and-comers? Who are in the same boat as us? So this is all about the future. You know, today's competitor can be leading today, could be in the dumpster tomorrow, right? I mean, you see that in technology here in particular all the time, but it's really important knowing and understanding what's going on in the industry as a whole, what's going on in your customers if you segment them, and then who is doing the same things as us, who is doing things differently, who's doing things better than us, and how do we learn from that? How and why do the competitors win bids that we lose? First of all, you even invited to the table, right? And then are you tracking? We find a lot of companies don't track how and what bids they're winning, what bids they're losing, and then we're big fans of what we call postmortems. If you lose a bid, get a team together to figure out why you lost it. I mean, and it's not just typically one simple answer, right? We lost because, yes?
As a corollary to that, we actually go past the client or the prospect and say, we're not trying to win the business back, but can you tell us why you chose them and what could we have done better?
That's great.
And that way we're getting direct feedback rather than guessing, because the internal group has a tendency to guess at what the decision was, and most of the time we find folks will be candid with, if you approach it the right way, you'll get the candid answer, especially if it's on their turf, it's a one-on-one as opposed to you bring in 40 people, so that's something that works well.
That's great. What should we know about the competition? So that's a great question to ask the CEO, right? The emphasis is on the should. As a board member, you're never the expert, right? You're never the expert in the company, the industry, the trends, what's going on there. So, in another way to pose the question to the CEO is, if I started a competing business today, what would I do to win over your customers or your clients? It's obviously theoretical. You're not, as a board member, going to do that, but it's a great question to ask and see how they answer. Any questions or comments on?
Yeah, I'll give you a comment just for an exercise. We didn't do this, but we should have done it. We did the SWOT analysis.
Yep.
You know, every year it was an inside joke. You know, fold your paper in half. Here we go again. And we always found the same thing, that our strength was that Walmart was our largest customer, and our weakness was that Walmart was our largest customer.
Yep.
What were we going to do about it? But in a case where you have few large competitors, do the SWOT analysis on your competitor and see how you'd manage them. Because I'll give you, for example, and I saw this all the time in high tech, right? What we were working on in the black, you know, lab was going to knock the socks off the market. And nobody actually thought that our competitors had one of those little labs too.
That's a great point. And we also believe the same thing with acquisitions. If you're company A and you're going to acquire company B, you've got the SWOT analysis of company A, do a SWOT analysis of company B, and do a layering thing to figure out, is the 1 plus 1 really going to equal 3, not 1 plus 1 equal 2, or 1 plus 1 equal less than 1, which we've seen some of the acquisitions too. So we're big fans of that. It makes sense.
Less than 1.
Yeah, oh, we've seen that. We can give you examples of that. Pretty scary. And then we want to talk about watchouts, you know, what to look out for. So again, in terms of framing the discussion, asking see about the competitor, what are things we see out there that are mistakes? Discussion at too high a level. This relates to long-term strategy, not day-to-day. So this is a good example. It happened recently. You know, CEO presented how their brand was going to be positioned over the next year. This is where it's gone. This is the history. Here's where we think the market share. And afterward, one of the board members asked the senior vice president of sales, who said, well, that was just a presentation. If you take a deep dive, you'd know that our competition is doing X, Y, Z, and they're beating us in 6 of our 9 markets we operate in. So a very different thing. So again, discussion at too high a level. You really want to be able to do the deep dives in there and ask the questions. You know, how real is this? How good is this? How do you feel? What are the pluses and minuses that are going to happen? Competitors dismissed as immaterial. It seems like this happens a lot. I don't know if you see this on boards. Don't worry about them, or we're already the leader in the category. But really understanding your competition in terms of what they're doing better, doing an honest assessment, what they're doing better, what they're doing worse for you. And don't ever think they're stupid, because there's an assumption that goes, oh, they don't know, or they don't have as good a sale, they don't have a good amount. I mean, you hear that all the time. This is another big watch out that we see in general about materials for the board not being sent out a minimum of 5 days in advance. You need the board to be properly prepared to ask questions about your board strategy, and this also relates to the next topic about board presentations. Reading PowerPoints is a total waste of time for everybody in the room.
It's the standard.
I know it is the standard. You're right, Tom.
Think about that.
Yes.
No, it is.
All of these issues revolve around that.
No, you're right. And there's nothing more irritating to board members than having a senior management read slides they've already read. Highlight key issues, highlight key points, and assume that the board members have already read them, but talk about what the real issues are. And it's amazing how many boards that we see out there that literally they think we put up the PowerPoint and we start reading through them. Boards are victims of what the management wants to share. So as a board member, you're always the victim of what the management wants to share. So if the CEO sees the board as a resource, they should be sharing valuable information about their company, their competitors in the marketplace, strategically. How are you positioned better than your competitors? We even think it's great ideas to have a major customer come present to your board and talk about what's going on in the marketplace. And by the way, they see that as a huge honor. They don't see that as an imposition. They actually see, oh, I could present. Oh, sure, I'd like to do that. And that's a great way for board members to be able to have a better understanding of what's going on in the marketplace. We have limited time, so we can't discuss strategy. Really? What did you bring in all these board members for? It's the whole purpose of the board. And then I think someone was mentioning before, it was you, George, about insular about the business. Having a narrow view of the world can be dangerous. So you want to make sure the CEO and the board are really involved at the customer level. The company is spending enough time outside understanding the marketplace and the competition. Competition's only discussed during comp time, during compensation time. I mean, once a year when it comes to compensation, that's when they discuss, look at our competitors and let's, We've all been through it. We all hire all these firms that specialize in it, but that cannot be the only time you're discussing about the competitors. Competitors should be discussed year-round. It's an absolute sin to only a comp time to say, well, look at what they're paying compared to what we're being paid.
Larry, that's why you spend the whole year telling everybody how incompetent the competition is.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. It all feeds into it, Neil. Data dumps, sloppy joes. You have to pick it up and figure out how to eat it. And this is what I was talking about before. You know, don't just send a 38-page report. It's important to provide the board with what are the key issues, this is what you were talking about before, what are the key metrics that are important, and then you can just attach the details. But don't just send that report. Senior management can develop a dashboard that, again, is relevant to the company, relevant to the injury. These are three or four things we're tracking. These are three or four things we're looking at. But what they tend to do is they overwhelm the board. I mean, we've seen some of these presentations that are being sent to the board, hundreds of pages long. And we talk to the board members and we're advising the board. What am I supposed to, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. Am I just supposed to read it? I mean, there's no questions, there's no thought process behind it. So again, provide the board with what you want them thinking about, what you want the issues, guide them. Ideas to understand the competition. So these are ideas to really, so one of the other things said, if you're looking at, okay, you're asking these questions about the competition, how do you really have a better understanding? So these are ideas, and you probably have a lot more in the room, that we've seen work really well. Have a board meeting at a trade show. The night before a trade show, I'm too busy during the trade, great, we'll do it the day before. And then the board members walk around the trade show. Now, obviously, you're only doing this with the permission of the CEO, of the head of sales, so they all embrace and say it's a great idea. But it's great for you as a board member. You get to see, is the booth busy during the 3 days of the show, or is it empty? You know, what are our competitors doing? How are they positioning themselves from marketing, from a sales point? You can walk in a lot of competitors' booths. I mean, you're getting the board there by scheduling a board meeting. So we're huge fans of this. Second of all, board meetings at a manufacturing plant. We've seen boards meet all the time, every board meeting for years at their headquarters, and they never visit any of the manufacturing plants. And we deal with and talk to the heads of the manufacturing and say, you know what, that's all done at headquarters. Like, they don't even feel like they're really part of the company. It sends such an unbelievable message for the board to actually go and walk through the manufacturing plant, meet with the senior management, meet with the plant manager, and see what's going on. Also, if the board has experience, whether it's in manufacturing or other areas, they often can say, you know, these are things I'm seeing, or they start to ask more intelligent questions. So educating board members is key. Third thing, board meetings that a company recently acquired. It's another thing. You acquire a company, but you never have board meetings there. I mean, and often this entire senior management team sitting there. And so, you know, again, we spend enough time advising these boards, and we'll go and visit some of these companies, and they say, well, they say we're part of it, but if you look at what really goes on, the board's never even been here visiting us. You know, I know they just bought us for $150 million, but they don't even come visit us. We've never met any of the board members. So again, it's a great message to have, to say you're part of the parent company, have a board meeting there, and again, get engaged with the people. Google alerts. I mean, today's technology, it's so easy to have Google alerts on the competitors and on the company itself. So you know the company, you've identified it, you get the Google alerts. Now, that said, what irritates board members if they're reading an important announcement publicly and they have no idea it's happening. And that's like surprising your bank. You don't want to do that. Marketing teams present competitive analysis quarterly. So again, thinking about what information, because you were asking that before, and how it gets presented. This we think is crucial. It's invaluable for the board to understand the competition. Have your marketing team present it and do a competitive analysis. You can see how you're positioned versus your competitor. Management provides recaps of trade periodicals and analyst reports. We've gone back and forth on this. There's some board members who want to have all the trade rags they can. You know what? Subscribe me to Textile Today, for, you know, all the different ones out there, and the food ones and everything. There are others who say, I would rather you do a recap and give me the trends. Talk about what is going on out there, how what our competitors are doing, how they're positioning themselves, how we're reacting. But you don't want to find out something from a third-party resource either. But these analyst reports and trade periodicals, we think, are absolutely crucial and invaluable. And if you do spend any time looking at the trade magazines, they provide insight that you don't see anywhere else. So they're really good. Salesforce, we talk about marketing team, but Salesforce presents a competitive analysis quarterly. The Salesforce knows and understands what you're doing versus your competitors in the marketplace. So this is a big issue, because the key is, how do you get the information all the way to the headquarters, right? So you have the salespeople throughout the country, internationally, you have the distributors and stuff, and they will sometimes communicate it to their sales managers, district managers, and that will sometimes get communicated to the senior VP of sales, which will sometimes get communicated to the CEO and the board. So you want to really try to set up a process there. And in fact, we've gone through, because we think it's to go through, what questions they should be asking. But when you're there in front of a customer, and a salesperson can ask these questions about the competitors, you know, oh, I'm seeing this, or I noticed they just did a promotion or something in marketing, and getting that feedback is crucial. But again, it's got to go all the way up, and they got to feel like it's valuable for them to share, that they're really part of the team, and not they want to keep it because they're worried about, if I share this, I'm giving up a competitive, you know, sort of thing. So spend time on the front line. You know, shop the competitors. If you're on a restaurant board, you know, visit the restaurant, but also visit the competitors, right? You know, do your own homework. It's amazing to us how many people don't do homework. In fact, just talking to one of our board members last night, he was saying he sits on, I think, 12 boards total, 6 public boards, and he was saying that it's amazing to him how many people that he's interviewing for public boards that know nothing about the company, and they're walking in for an interview for a board position. Like, how is that in today's day and age? And it just happened to him last week. He said someone came in and they said, so tell me about the company. He's like, you're interviewing for a board position, you don't know about our a publicly held company. So you can find out almost anything you want about it, plus their competitors. So, I mean, really, you know, spend time on the front line, find out what's going on. So, comments or questions on this? Does this make sense, or?
Question for yourself or anyone else. So in a situation where you have a CEO who is competent to develop strategy and recommend strategy,
right?
Do you see the board's role as, if you will, approving strategy, redirecting, or developing strategy?
I have my opinion, but does anyone want to comment?
I would say all of the above. Mm-hmm. I've seen boards develop strategy, usually in conjunction with the CEO. I've seen boards change strategies. Again, generally in conjunction with CEO. CEO wants to go one way, so the board goes another way. You got a problem. Mm-hmm. You got to resolve it. And I've seen CEOs come to their boards with a pivot and say, this is how I want to reorganize my company. And then the board's got to, you know, ask all the relevant questions. Okay, why is this more effective in terms of execution?
So,
Alan?
Good. So I'll come from a public company viewpoint, which can be very different from a private company. And from a public company viewpoint, actually the guidance from the National Association of Corporate Directors is very clear. It is supposed to be management who develops the strategy that the board reviews, questions, pushes back, but is the approver.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's the old noses and fingers out thing.
Yeah.
You're not management.
Right.
And so it's a very clear demarcation. I think with private boards, first of all, you don't have all the regs and compliance and the guidance, so it really becomes, you know, I've seen what you've seen, I've seen different things, but what I like now from my current private boards, private corporate boards, put nonprofits in a different box, is my CEOs, I ask them to present their strategy, their vision, where they want to take it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a variation on the public board because it's a private board and you have a lot more push and pull in a different way. But it always, to me, it has to start with the CEO and the management team and where they want to take it.
Claire, I'll take a minute. Take a shot. So I agree. If the board is developing strategy, They need a new CEO.
Yeah.
Because
there we go. We go back to point number.
Point number one, because you said, you know, if the CEO is not the CEO, right? The board doesn't know everything about the company and the competitors, and is in no position to do it. However often they meet in as much time, so it has to be developed. To Ellen's point, and I appreciate the fiduciary responsibility, no end. That said, there are discussions and there are interrogations. And if you're, so if you take your fiduciary role as a board and say, we are collectively as a board, X the CEO is on the board, we are the super audit committee.
That's not a board.
Right? Then management is not, then you're in a position where management doesn't share with you. So the notion of sort of interaction, use the board for advisor, that pushback is advisory as much as it is fiduciary. We've had the robust discussion. We do this all the time in the M&A. We've had the discussion. It's not an interrogation. It's a discussion, right? And in terms of sort of formal approval, that's the least of it. You either have consensus or you don't. If you don't have consensus.
Scary, I actually agree with you.
Wow. And it's being taped, Ellen.
It's scary.
Other comments or questions on strategy? Rick?
This is a really good dialogue. I was going to throw in the question of what do you see as the difference between having the CEO as the chairman of the board and the non-executive chairman of the board? How do you see it working? I'm agreeing with what you're saying, but I'm just saying that there's a different dynamic as to how it's managed in those two cases.
Well, actually, I have a couple of each. And where the CEO is also the chairman of the board, you know, we have very strong lead independent directors, very strong. You know, they may not have the title of chairman, but they run the board meeting. And they run the conversations that we were talking about. So, you know, at least in my boards, whether chairman CEO is together or separated, at least it functions as if it's separate.
Yeah, I've seen both. The dynamic and strength of personality matters way more than whether you give a weak director a strong CEO said, well, we can't have it together, so we'll make the other person the chairman, you know, and then, you know, someone's lunch gets eaten. It doesn't work. On the other hand, if you have someone who's sort of power title crazy, and, you know, chairman, CEO, president, and whatever else, surrounded by, you know, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, but you get it either way. I don't find that the title matters much.
It may matter to the outside rating agency, which has nothing to do with your topic.
Right.
But it may have everything to do with the whole brouhaha in public companies about do you separate chairman and CEO. Just to ISS, this is a very important thing.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about it, having been chairman of a number of boards, that it's the whoever is, whether they have the title or not, sets the cultural expectations for the board and gives permission for people who have differences of opinion to come in and really speak. Because a lot of people you know, they don't really, they're uncomfortable with having to get up in a board meeting and disagree with whoever the leader is. And the truth is that the value of having the mayor is to draw out from them. Sometimes you need to go through that process of drawing out the differences of opinion. It can't be just, okay, we'll all sit around, who has a difference of opinion? I mean, it doesn't work that way.
Size of board matters. So if you're on a 5 to 7 person board, it's way easier. That's only this from here over. Yeah. It's way easier to have a discussion without a leader. If you're in one of those big bank boardroom things where you've got 37 people at the table, then it's way harder.
Is your question about public and private, or just public companies?
Say it again.
Are you referring to both private and public companies in your separation of CEO and chairman, or are you talking about more public companies?
My experience has mostly been on private, but I mean, Ellen has much more experience in the public than I do.
The public makes sense. I didn't know if private was different from your perspectives.
I mean, the other question that I raised, and you was having been chairman of a couple of boards, but interested in Ellen's point of view as well on public boards, is whether it's a lead director or a chairman, to the extent you are reflection of the board as the boss and the CEO. And so you're gonna have some offline conversations. I remember a couple of years ago, one of the NACD conversations, the then CEO of Raytheon was speaking. And he made it, and afterwards I chatted with him, and he said, well, I'm off to have a conversation with my lead director. He was chairman and CEO. And, oh, by the way, compensation's the issue. You know, he was going to sit down and walk through his reviews of each of his senior managers with the lead director. All right. That, to me, was a well-functioning relationship in terms of whether the lead director was chairman or not. The CEO respected the person enough to say that I've got to go review everything that I want to do with him.
And in fact, just so you know, he has to actually get it formally approved by the compensation committee,
right,
of the board before he can actually enact it.
Right, but in order to go,
they're all independent.
That's correct. But the key to going to the compensation committee was he already had. He did his reviews with the lead director and then got approval to go to the compensation committee.
Yeah, so I'd say administratively, if you have a public company and it's large enough to be a complex public company, you have an audit committee and a comp committee and a governance committee and whatever other sorts of committees the NACD and others will dream up, then to have all of that sort of administratively roll up to the CEO, because the CEO's also the chairman, is just keep you busy. And in that case, to have a separate chairman or a lead director who can take that governance. One point I'll raise, my former...
All right, now we're disagreeing.
Okay, so my...
okay, Alan, go for it.
My former employer would almost always have a board dinner the night before a board meeting. Private room, it was casual,
right.
It was chat, and it's a great way to take all of the advisory, strategic, what's going on with the customers, what's new at the show, all of that out of the meeting. And then at the meeting, you can go through all the things you have to do. Like, you know, it doesn't add any value to approve last quarter's minutes, but you still have to do it. And, you know, all of that you can get through and you can get your board meeting done. We always had at least one director, just to prove how important this particular director was, who would, you know, never make it to the end of the meeting because he always had to grab his briefcase and catch an airplane. And that's a look how important I am. So don't count on me. But he always made it for the dinner.
No good. Alan, you're on.
I don't even know where to go with that. I mean, I'll come back to, we obviously don't agree with a lot of the things you just said, but that's all right. But I mean, coming back to your point, I mean, in public companies, whether you're the chairman or the lead director, the lead director, a good lead director, is clearly independent, is clearly driving the board agenda, is clearly driving the how the board functions. You know, I mean, so that's where we do agree, which is the title doesn't have to be important at all, right? If you get a dictatorial CEO who decides the title is the all being and he can try and run over his board, he ends up getting fired in public companies. Public companies today, because of, whether you want to call it bad or good, I mean, there are very clear, proper guidance, regulatory.
P&G is a good example.
That exists.
I mean, P&G had, you know, what's-his-face, it turned over the board.
Good old what's-his-face.
Well, he's...
Bob McDonald.
Yeah.
Bob McDonald, yep.
And he got turned over, and 2 years in, it was very clear he was not doing it. And so...
A.G. Lafley came in.
Back,
yep.
And turned, you know, had to do the turnaround again. And that's a good example of where, you know, the board, you know, with a strong lead director, basically said, he's not cutting it. They went back to the old guy and said, you got to come back in here while we to figure this out, and then we will go do the search again for a new CEO.
Larry?
With more companies going private, particularly through PE money.
Right.
Changing some things, right? So we're talking about public companies and some big ones, but a lot of the mid-sized folks are
private.
I mean,
private.
There, a lot of folks are looking for the exits, especially now that things have gotten better, and they're going to more private places, it looks to me at least. So that's a little different situation, or do you see it as the same, Ellen, especially where you're working with both?
Because can I just interrupt just 1 minute? I was supposed to give you a time thing, but we got started late, so
okay.
I'd like to run it till 10 after 6, if that's okay with people. It's a little later than usual, but okay.
So I wonder about that dynamic,
and
are you seeing things, are people seeing things change as a result of that?
Well, you know, I mean, Larry has also sat on a lot of public and private boards. It's interesting. What I see is that there was a real drop in terms of number of public companies. If you look at the statistics, there are many fewer public companies now than existed 10 years ago, 15 years ago. They're actually now on the rise again, because the markets have gotten better, so more companies are going public. I mean, you know, it's still, there are fewer public companies than before. You know, my private companies, and you know, one of the things we do in the NACD is we name a best private board, you know, every year at our director of the year. And so we're really focused on, and certainly the boards I sit on, are focused on functioning. You may be a private board, but the best governance practices from the public companies, without all the compliance stuff, you know, we're trying to get into all our private boards. And so most of us who sit on both, that's what we're trying to do. And in fact, at the upcoming nonprofit program in February, Maura Healy is actually going to be leading off. And a lot of the message from the mass government on the nonprofits is going to be, take the best practices from the public companies, and they should be driven not just into private companies, but into the nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the messages are coming together, but you know, the difference is, of course, you don't have all the regulatory stuff, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't still try to pick the best of the practices, right? Whatever they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, but one of the buyout groups that I've done a lot of work with, and invest quite often with them, the guy who runs that buyout group is a very effective board director. And he serves both on his investment, but he's also then, when he sells it to a public company, he'll go on to the public company board as well.
But you just mentioned a very good point. That's what a lot of private companies are doing. I'm glad you mentioned that. Is by having the good governance and by being set up
right,
as if you're a public, you get an easier sell when you want to.
Then right. If you want it, correct.
Back to a public company,
yep.
Right.
Act like a public company, right?
You can bring that
Other questions or comments?
One of the other things that we do for our company, again, we're privately held. We're a B2B organization in the tech services, and we have 300 to 400 clients, so we're not talking about millions. But we run quarterly client advisory boards, and we actually have a lot of success getting client groups together and running roundtables. Actually, have one coming tomorrow. We have two board members, actually a board member and a prospective board member coming. And that gives them a chance to talk with some folks, and it gives them both sides, because the competition is kind of the other side of the coin of your customers or your clients, in terms of what are they doing and why are they doing what they're doing. And at least in tech, today's competitor may be very different from tomorrow's competitor.
Right.
Tom and I were talking about folks in the media industry and folks like Netflix and Amazon actually now creating content, which is different from what it was a few years ago. So, and because of the work that I do for my company, we're trying to do that and instill that in the board to ask those questions, because the traditional competitors
change.
They're changing rapidly in the early morning part.
The disruption is so important now, because you could have a little shop down the street, and all of a sudden he comes out with a product. I mean, people forget that Facebook was number two in the market. MySpace owned it, and then Fox screwed it up. All right. People forget that Plaxo was first in the market, and then LinkedIn came in and blew them away. All right.
AltaVista. AltaVista.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually true.
Remember?
You know, Microsoft made a fortune. It's because IBM three times passed on buying them.
Good. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We can
thank you very much.